In my experience of being with the dying process, I think what happens is the fact the veil gets thin between the known world and the unknown world.
Right.
I'm not sure it's about life, but where for me it is, I think it's about consciousness, the continuation of consciousness, because life, the life of that person that we understand who they are is dying. There's no question about that. The life force is leaving them. But this sense of consciousness or merging with consciousness is the continuum. Mm-hmm. And that's what I find fascinating about being with the dying. That's the sort of the, oh, wow, this is incredible experience. And a lot of people say it's a humbling experience. It's they call it a privilege to sit with the dying.
This is the When You Die podcast. If it has to do with death and dying, we're talking about it. I'm Johanna Lunn, your host today.
With me today is Sue Brain, author, podcast host, and therapist. For the past 20 years, Sue has been helping people to transform their relationship with mortality through her end-of-life research, workshops, and books on spirituality, consciousness, and death and dying. She is author of Living Fully, Dying Consciously, The Path to Spiritual Well-Being, The D Word, Talking About Death, and a wonderful book for children, Granny Mo, Is Teddy Going to Die? For many years, she worked as a therapist specializing in trauma, end-of-life issues, bereavement, and grief. Sue is host of Embracing Your Mortality podcasts and hosts death cafes regularly on Zoom. Her website is suebrain.co.uk. I am so happy to be talking with you again. I think you're one of my favorite people to have these conversations with because you have such a broad view on living and dying. And it's a view that I think we really need to explore. Well, obviously, the When You Die Project does believe we need to explore our humanity in all aspects of it. So welcome and thank you.
Well, thank you too. It's lovely to see you again.
And I think today we'll go a lot of places, but I want to talk about your book. I know it came out in 2020, but because of COVID, it just came out last week.
That's for sure.
It's hard to get people's attention these days. The book is Living Fully, Dying Consciously, The Path to Spiritual Well-Being. The thing I love about this book is that it is the whole enchilada. There's lots of areas of life and death that we can drill down on and that have a lot of rich things to reveal. I think it's partly just your background and having spent so much time hosting death cafes and your own curiosity that you've brought forward all of this rich material of asking this question, why are we afraid of living fully? What is that about? So I'm just going to throw that at you.
Okay, I'll catch it. Is there anything you can do, I think? Gosh, it's such a huge question. Particularly, I think we need to look at the Western relationship with death, really, because in my experience, being out to the East and studying Buddhism and various other Eastern traditions, they don't have the same angst to do with death that we do. But I think that's because their belief system, their religious belief system is part of their life. It's like eating and drinking, where we segregate it. We keep it on a Sunday or whenever we feel like we want to partake in any form of sacred union. It isn't really part of our tradition or our culture. Increasingly less so, because now I'm really secular society, especially in the UK. My thought about that through all the journey that I've been on to try and understand this thing called the human condition in my Western understanding of it, obviously, is how can we communicate or commune with each other and nature and all that is without embracing something greater than us? Because if we don't have a respect for something greater, we believe we're in charge and we are not. And I think that's where the tragedy is unfolding. And I can only talk for the UK here. Our whole society is beginning to collapse because I think it's been ego driven, obviously, and without any form of spiritual underpinning. I think it was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross who used to talk about four quadrants, the physical, the spiritual, the mental, and the emotional. But if you only focus on the physical, emotional, and mental, you've got a three-legged table. The fourth leg is missing. So it will collapse because the spirituality, the consciousness, holds the whole thing up. And I see that everywhere, that sort of sense of this collapse happening. And I think my only hope is that through the collapse, we turn to a greater understanding of our true place in the world, which really is about being a custodian to this planet. That's what we agreed to do when we came here. And we've completely negated that. And people are turning more or respecting nature more. But we've got this huge dichotomy with massive organizations and institutions and businesses that are still continuing to rape the planet. Trouble is, do you and I want to give up our nice, comfortable way that we live for them to stop rating the planet? And this is a massive conflict of interest. So we're in this place at the moment of massive conflict and chaos and, what's the word for it? Paradox, if you like.
Yeah.
And we're nowhere near finding any form of resolution as yet.
Right. Right. So that is definitely the macro view here. And I think within that, it's the two sides of the coin, right? We are terrified of death and we are really terrified to make a statement about our life, what it is to live because, well, I guess I can just speak from my own life's experience. I think for the longest time, I felt like to really live the way that I wanted to live, which was more harmoniously with nature, some simplicity and being able to see the sunrise in the morning and the sunset. I love nature. I have a daughter and she needs to be raised and she needs to go to school and she needs all these things and a house and in the city. Once you kind of get plugged into a big corporate salary, then you've got that kind of thing going like, oh my God, well, if I quit this job, then who am I going to be? And I remember when I left broadcasting, I was sitting on my best friend's sofa. She was like, you should do it. You've got to go. You got to get out of here. It's a hamster wheel. It's eating you up, blah, blah, blah. She was also on that hamster wheel, by the way. But it's okay for me to go, right? And I said, you know, you have to promise me that if I become destitute, I can sleep on your sofa. And she was like, absolutely. I was like, okay, I will have some place to sleep.
Yeah. I mean, that's where we go to, isn't it? It's real fear that I will not be supported. If I give up on the system that has held me in place in my gilded cage for all these years, if I give up on that, I will not be supported. And it's a fear of lack. We've been programmed to believe that. And I think human beings are fantastically resourceful. I always have, and incredibly creative. And actually put a person against the wall and say, right, here's the problem. Amazingly, they'll think of something. It may not feed into the system. They may not end up earning millions of dollars or pounds or have a fantastic label on their head that says, oh, I don't know, CEO of big company. Mm-hmm. But they may actually find the creative inspiration to do something really different and innovative for the community, right, not just for themselves and their family. And I think that's what I'm seeing. And I think that's what COVID's done. It threw people back on themselves. They lost their jobs or they were furloughed or whatever it was. And suddenly the creative juices started to flow. And amazing things have come out of that. Do we ever hear about these people? No, we don't. But incredible, innovative ideas have taken root because of us being thrown back on ourselves. And that's what gives me hope.
And, you know, I think when you're able to sit at the bedside of someone who is dying, that sense of presence and life is so vivid. One person described it as when someone is dying, and I think this is true, their consciousness expands out so that it's almost like walking into somebody's spiritual body in a way. And that's that kind of electric feeling that when you walk into the room of someone who's dying, it's very awake. Even when it's difficult or labored, there's a lot going on there that is very, very alive. And that's a huge paradox, that life could be so present in the face of death. As someone who has had this experience, I can say that it's given me more confidence that there is something greater than just the physical material world. I mean, I also have other experiences as well, but there's just something that death can teach us.
In my experience of being with the dying process, I think what happens is the fact the veil gets thin between the known world and the unknown world.
Right.
I'm not sure it's about life, but where for me it is, I think it's about consciousness, the continuation of consciousness, because the life of that person that we understand who they are is dying. There's no question about that. The life force is leaving them. But this sense of consciousness or merging with consciousness is the continuum. And that's what I find fascinating about being with the dying. That's the sort of oh, wow, this is incredible experience. And a lot of people say, it's a humbling experience. It's they call it a privilege to sit with the dying. And I don't think it's because they're watching somebody dying in a linear sense. I think they're being moved by the whole of what consciousness possibly means within the context of that person dying and their consciousness continuing as a stream, as the Buddhists teach, that sort of stream of consciousness continues. And I find that absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well said, for sure. Yeah, I think I was using the term life from that point of view of that consciousness has vitality to it.
Oh, yes. It's got qualities to it. It's so difficult to put into words because we don't have the vocabulary. It's beyond my ability to communicate what it's about. It's just so awesome. I think the only word is just, oh my God, this is awesome. When you're open, I mean, there's so many people are closed down because of the grief that they're feeling about this person dying. Yeah, I argue this case in the book that whatever happens, love is always present, because if you're grieving and falling apart because your treasured person is dying, but you have the courage to sit beside that person and hold their hand through your grief, that is love, like no other love, because you're putting them first and you second. And I call that this the greater love. I think there's two, again, terrible vocabulary around this, but there's sort of the lesser love, inverted commas, which is human love, which is lovely, but it's always got conditions put on it. And don't leave me. And if you do, I'll die. And, you know, all that kind of stuff. And fear of being abandoned and fear, you know, and it's all about being abandoned, a human love. This greater love is absolutely unconditional. It just goes way, way beyond this human love. And I find it's so rare to experience it. And I think you really only experience possibly when a baby's born and you go beyond yourself and, oh, wow. And when somebody dies, oh, wow, what happened there?
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Amazing. And do you think that there's any mini versions of that throughout the course of a life? Do we experience this in more, I'd say almost mundane ways, or is it really just the two great portals?
I think some of us really, really connect with life, don't we? And we go into nature and we have these incredible experiences, cuddling a tree or sitting beside the water and letting the elements speak to us. And those take us out of ourselves. I think we can get it through holotropic breathwork and incredible things like that. People are having an amazing experience nowadays with guided psilocybin experiences. And I've experienced all of that and more. I've even had a mystical experience which took me outside of myself. But it's something about that sitting with the dying, being present with consciousness in its process of transformation from physical being into, who knows, the stream. That for me is utterly unique. And other people may disagree with me on that, actually, and fair enough, but that's my experience.
So let's talk a little bit more about kind of the cultural fear and anxiety and guilt that seems to be so pervasive right now in our culture that prevent us from being in the stream.
Yeah, wouldn't it be great if we all lived in the stream and we just went, oh, we're just passing through, going to make the best of this, been going and leave the body behind and off I go again. And oh, by the way, I can see, I know who my next incarnation is going to be. I just love, you know, I think that's just completely cool. And I know where I've come from, you know, I'm passing on the baton, which, you know, that's how I look at my end of life, is I'm passing on this consciousness baton to somebody else who's going to incarnate, carrying the collective consciousness that I carry to pass on. Yeah, that would be a good way to live, wouldn't it? Or awareness, anyway.
Or I'll just throw in another element here, because yeah. I love this quote, and you use it in your book, and it was in a very popular film in the 70s as well. It's from Chief Low Dog, the Lakota chief. It's a good day to die. Yeah. I remember seeing that in the film in the 70s. I think it was with Dustin Hoffman, Little Big Man. And I was like, it was almost played comedically, right? Yeah. It's a good day to die. When the sun sets, he gets like, I guess it wasn't a good day to die today. There's something about having your business all taken care of that you die today.
The most important thing for anyone is to make peace with themselves. However hideous their life has been, whatever shame and guilt they're carrying, it's about how do I reconcile with that and recognize that all I'm having is a human experience, and it's the way I relate to that human experience that matters. And that really is communing with yourself, and find somebody to help you to do that. And it can take years, and it can take less than that, but it's a willingness to engage with it, because there's nothing more closing down than actually even more than fear. Well, fear is guilt and shame. Yeah, it is. And that is where the big ice blocks are in our consciousness and in our ability to connect and communicate well. Oh God, I don't want to sort of hurl insults at any organizations, but I think last 2000 years plus, the church, when it started off, did a jolly good job on making us feel guilty for being here or being alive. Some of the teachings are very dodgy around that. And when the church put the priest in the middle of our relationship with God, which was the indigenous people, and we've all come from that originally, we had a direct connection with God. And then the church went, oh, no, you can't do that. Well, you have to go through the priest, and we're going to put all the teachings into Latin so you don't understand them, and off you go. Okay, that was a long time ago, but we're still carrying the patriarchal conditioning. That's no decrying men, by the way, but this patriarchal conditioning that we've all grown up with. And I actually grew up with it as a child. I was born in the very early 50s, and there was an expectation that you went to church and did your mea culpa. even though I didn't even know what I was mea culpaing about. You have to make it up. I think, you know, when you're entrenched in that you are a bad person just because you are, it's very hard. It's so shaming, and it's really tough to ditch that. And I think waking up these days is about going, I'm not going to do that anymore. I am going to consider my own relationship with the divine, whatever that means to me, and take responsibility for my belief and how I enact that in my life. But we have been extremely programmed, and I don't think we should underestimate how programmed we are in the West. It's very different in the East.
I love that in your book, there are a lot of different exercises to work through a lot of the things that you're talking about. I think it's part of one of the things I love about a book that really includes living and dying in one place, that really there are tools here to discuss and to experience and to release all that ingrained stuff. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, is there any exercise that off the top that you could think of that you might want to share with us?
I worked as a psychotherapist for quite a while, and I specialized in trauma. Let's face it, everybody's traumatized on some level by just being here, breathing this air, and this physical body is traumatic enough for the spirit who has to incarnate into it. So let's not deny that. And I think the most important thing is to instill inside you a safe place. And that is to imagine a beautiful place. It doesn't have to be real. You can make it up, or it can be real. Wherever you feel a beautiful place, I'll give you an instance. Mine is in a wood, dappled sunshine coming through the woods. And I've got a lovely hammock strung between two trees. And my cat who died is in the hammock. And I go there whenever I need to feel safe, or I'm in a situation that I don't particularly enjoy, but it just builds this sense of core, this sense of it's okay, it's self-soothing. And I've got a stream running through it, and it's all green and verdant. I've got champagne on the side and little nibbles if I want them. You know, just make it as some people want to walk beside a beach or the sea or wherever it is for you. If you've been very traumatized as a child, it's really hard to go inside because there isn't that safety core. So it's about finding an object like a teddy bear that you can cuddle, that you can feel safe with, or an object that you feel an attachment to. It. This is about attachment. It's about attaching to something that makes you feel safe. And practice it all the time. It's like going to the gym. The more you practice it, the more real it becomes and the more safer that you feel in. For me, I find yoga really helpful because it makes my body feel strong. And when my body feels strong, I feel strong inside. So some people do Tai Chi or some form of movement, and it doesn't have to be vigorous. Some people kickbox, but you know, it might be, I don't know, just going for a very gentle walk mindfully. It's working with the body, because guess what? The body's home, not the house. It's the body. Without your body, you're not here. This body enables you to be on this planet alive, having your experiences. And we forget that. We think it's our physical home, and it isn't. It's our body. We need the physical home to give us the safety and the structure to feel safe, obviously, but home is the body, and that's why it's important to enable yourself to feel strong and feel safe.
I think we might have the whole body thing a little turned around in this culture, because so much attention is paid to how you look and what you dress. The whole shebang. I don't know. I'm trying to decide if COVID sort of softened that a little bit, but I don't really think so. The proliferation of how to cut your own hair videos, you know, on YouTube came in handy, but
the thing is that we live in this celebrity culture, and everybody wants to be famous now, and everybody wants to be an influencer. And they think if they're famous, they're safe. because everybody's looking at them. But of course, that isn't true, because the more people look at you, the more you feel insecure. So the more you try and, I don't know, build more. And if it's all external, there's nothing internal going on. And this internal body is where we build ourselves from the inside out, never from the outside in. It just doesn't work.
Right. Good point.
Oh, and by the way, in my experience of being with the dying, people who do not have a strong core as they die can have a really difficult time, because it's very scary. Letting go is really scary. But if you've got an inner core and you've really worked on yourself and you know who you are, it's not scary, because you know what's happening to you healthily and with engagement.
That's a wonderful, wonderful point. We've often said this, and so many people have, is it's the fear of the unknown, because we don't know, and we don't know what happens when we die. So we are afraid of what we don't know. And letting go, I mean, we even just in the smallest ways, day to day, it's hard to let go of something. I have a regular seasonal practice of cleaning things out. What clothes do I not wear? It's like, oh, no, you'll be good for next season, you know? And I just can't let it go. In that case, oh, I haven't worn it in however many years, so why can't you let it go? And it's the smallest thing, and it's the most insignificant thing. But the bigger thing of letting go of body and image and breath and loved ones and pets and companions, or not pets, there are companions. Those are big letting go things. So what you're saying about really knowing your home base, your body strength, how air passes through your lungs, and all of those movement things that are ways that you get to know the parameter of your body. And if you meditate, then you get a broader sense perhaps of the parameter of your body. Then you sort of have a different idea of what you're actually letting go of.
Yeah, and I really understand that a lot of people have really huge problems with body image. And I get that, because that's been fed that we're never good enough, or we're never young enough, or we don't look in a certain way. And God, just let me get the Botox and everything will be fine. But if you can change that relationship about the body image is the external thing, the true essence. And it's hard to self-love when you've had a crap time and when you've had a crap childhood. It's really, really tough. But if you can change your relationship with that to say, this is my home while I am on this planet, therefore I need to have some form of relationship with it internally, not just externally. I think if we change the perception of it and realize that, yeah, it's about, this is home. Mm-hmm. Or otherwise you shed your body and you go. Mm-hmm. And I find it really interesting and curious that this thing called spirit, and I think it's the spirit, and I'm still working out the difference between soul and spirit. It could be the same, it could be two completely different things. I'm fluid with that. But whatever it is, has a fantastic tenacity to stay in the physical body. It wants the physical experience, no matter how crap things are. I've heard so many people talk about horrendous experiences, but they're still alive. People who've been horribly tortured during wars or brutalized in their childhood, but they're still here. And I find that absolutely amazing, this utter desire to stay in a physical body alive. And it's the work is, how do I integrate and make myself home again when I've been that brutalized, but I don't want to die.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a big thing, this, you know.
Mm-hmm. You really are talking about self-love here. And I think we have to love ourselves, warts and all, make friends with whatever your stuff is.
Yeah, I think for some people, self-love is too big a call. You've been so brutalized that that's gone, but you're still alive and you're willing to be alive. You must be engaging with life because you're still in your body. So how do you find a way to make this home and this home to feel as safe as it possibly can? And that is by creating safe places in us, by finding objects that we can connect to, that like cuddling a teddy or having a cat or a plant that you love, or something that soothes your soul, your troubled soul. Because I think the spirit is never corrupted, never. Mm. I think that is just the divine spark of life. And the soul, even though I just said, I don't know whether it's the same or isn't within this conversation, I think more that the soul is the lessons that we have to learn in life that maybe carries the karmic seeds that are ripening that we need to deal with. Goodness knows how it all works. But I just think self-love, for some people, it's too much to even mention those words. They can't go there.
So what does all of this have to do with dying consciously?
Oh, gosh, it's so big, isn't it? Well, the only person that we have intimate relationship with is ourselves. We think we have intimate relationships with other people, and we do. But, you know, we can only believe their stories. That's all we can do. They tell us their stories and we have to believe it or not. We know our own story, whether it's unconscious or it's conscious. We are the only intimate relationship that we have with ourselves. We can tell everybody else our story and they can believe it or not, but it's different. And I think for me, the people that, and I hate using the expression dying well, because I think that puts an onus again on people to do something at the end of life. And then they feel, oh, I haven't done very well. They're not dying well. And I feel it's my fault. They haven't had a good death. There's a lot of stuff that goes on around that, which I think is quite unhealthy. But if we take responsibility for whatever's happened in our life, we're going to die one day. I'm taking my dying process incredibly seriously. I'm 70 next year, and I look at my life now as a preparation for that. It could happen tomorrow. It could happen in 10 years' time. I really hope I'm not going to be here in 20. I don't want to be 90. That's no decrying anybody else who is 90, but that wouldn't work for me. How am I going to die as consciously as I possibly can and with a sense of peace? Because I've made huge mistakes in my life that still cause me anxiety at times. You know, you're walking down the street and whoop, the bubble comes up, or you're doing the ironing or whoop, that bubble comes up. And where does that come from? And so when it does come up, I just feel it and I just recognize it. And I just say, hello, you again. What can we do together? Do better. How can we put this to rest? You and me, not me and somebody else, but me and myself. That's how I'm preparing for my death. I don't feel morbid about it. I feel incredibly excited at the prospect of dying consciously. Incredibly excited by that and being as alive as I can be. And I want to feel that transition. I want to think, oh my God, this is what it's all been about. So it's about relating to yourself.
Beautiful, beautiful. I also 100% agree with you that the idea of a good death is really too much to put on people, which is why I like that term, a conscious death, because it can mean so many things. It can mean that you've done all your advanced directives and you have your will in place and you've cleaned out your house, or it's just some way that death is part of walking with you in life, because this moment will never happen again, or this sunrise we'll never see again, those kinds of things. And that does change the experience. And I know how many times I've been on autopilot in the course of the day, just rushing through all the things that need to be done, whatever it is that kind of snaps, and you go, oh, this moment right here, just cut the speed and be with it. I think that death can be a helpful contemplative reminder to stay more present.
What helps me is really understanding that this is my life story, and this, the only person who's ever lived it is me. And I now look at people as walking stories. When I see people walking around in the street, that's their story. Nobody else is ever going to have that story but them. And that's what makes us completely unique. Nobody's going to live the life I've had. They may live a similar life, but never my life. And it's the same with you. You're living your life. Nobody's ever going to live your life for you. It's not possible. So in whatever context you might find yourself in this life, having whatever human experience that you're having, it's unique to you. And when you die, the book closes. That's it. The story's finished. And how do you want to finish your story?
Oh, Sue, so good talking to you. I really appreciate this. And I love the full perspective that you bring with you in this wonderful book, Living Fully, Dying Consciously, The Path to Spiritual Well-Being. Who knew that life could be so rich or so challenging?
Not me when I came here. And I think if I had, I wouldn't have signed up. I'd have gone, no, I think I'm going to stay disincarnated. Thank you very much. Floating in the ethers. It's hard work here.
It certainly is. It certainly is. Well, thank you.
This conversation is brought to you by the When You Die Project. From existential afterlife questions to palliative care and the nuts and bolts of green burial, if it has to do with death, we're talking about it. WhenYouDie.org